For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Welcome, you guys, to our evening parenting meeting. This is something we try to do a couple times a year, is to have some in the evening, because normally we do these during the day. It's usually the first Wednesday of the month, and coming up in May 2nd, Beth Hemsworth is going to be teaching on helping kids develop healthy relationships. And so if you guys don't have to work or you don't get a chance to go to those meetings, you can also access those teachings online. We record all those teachings so that anybody can hear those later on. Also, I wanted just to give you a heads up about our Vacation Bible School we do every year. This year it's going to be June 18th through 22nd, and it's a great way for kids to serve and also to be served. So the younger kids can sign up, but then the older kids have an opportunity to serve and sign up too and volunteer, which is a lot of fun that the kids enjoy doing. I just wanted to, really grateful that we get to do this class. I know this time of your life can be very challenging with the tweens, but it's also really a great time too, because they get to really, you get to see them process and discover so many different things and figure out the way this world works and how to be able to interact with it. So I'm so grateful that Megan and Tony is also here to help us navigate through those times in our life. And so before I bring them up, I'm just going to open up with a word of prayer. God, I'm really grateful that you love us, that you love our kids even more, and that you put us in their life for a reason. And so I pray, God, that tonight you would help give us some nuggets of truth that we can really be able to apply and to be able to help understand our kids and to really be able to help them and to be the kind of people that you call them to be, God. Thank you that you have a vision for them, that you've uniquely made each one of them, and that you know what's best for them. And so I just pray for tonight, God, that you can give us your vision for our kids and help us to navigate with them through the choices they have to make, God. Amen. All right, Megan Kavinsky is going to come up, and she'll be able to tell you a little bit more about herself.
Hi. Oh, my gosh. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being invested, concerned parents. So hopefully we will answer questions and give you some really good information tonight on kids in the tween years. I want to tell you a little bit about who I am. My name is Megan Kavinsky. I am a licensed professional counselor. I practice at Beacon Counseling in Westerville. We are a Christian counseling agency that does clinical mental health. I love doing clinical work. It's really fun and exciting, but as I've found, as I've been practicing, it has affirmed everything about God that I've seen in my own life, and it's been an exciting journey to see that. So I am a counselor, but I'm also a Christian. I've been investing in the things of the Lord for about 20 plus years here at Xenos, and I have found that, especially in working in mental health, that the spiritual side and God coming along in and working with people is so exciting, because you have a realization that you can't do everything on your own. We are limited. Our hope, our strength, our perseverance only goes so far. And so it's exciting to see that there's a God out there who's bigger than us and has a plan for our lives and a purpose for us. So that's what I've experienced myself and in my practice. I love that God is a redeemer. He redeems pain and brokenness in our lives. He's done that for me and countless people that I know and I've worked with. So that's been exciting. So I hope to kind of reveal that and how God works in our lives and the lives of our kids, how we can help our kids figure that out and navigate that as well. Yeah, so I have seen, I guess, in no bigger challenge in my life than in parenting, God's hand and his redemption. My husband and I have three kids. Our oldest is just beginning her teen years. We have a tween, and we have a little one who's six. So I kind of have all the stages, and I know them well. So this class has been on my heart for years and years, so it's exciting to get to be here and talk about these kids in the tween age. I think that this age group, ages 8 to 12 roughly, are really overlooked in the parenting literature, the parenting category. We see a lot of stuff out there for early childhood, and we see a lot of stuff out there for high school teen years, but we don't see a whole lot for these kids in the school age years. So, and I think it needs some attention. So that's what we're going to do tonight. Tony, over here, Tony Donato, he is an intern at Beacon, and he's helped a lot with this class. He's got some things to say, too. So we're going to kind of tag team a little bit here. So, yeah.
Like she said, my name is Tony Donato. I actually met Megan, I think, 2016. She was a graduate assistant at Ashland University, and we got to kind of know each other a little bit. And then when I actually applied to be an intern at Beacon, I had no clue that she worked there. So it was kind of nice to see her. She's extremely passionate about this topic throughout this whole process. She really has a passion for tweens. I've actually got to sit in with her as a clinician as well, and she's a phenomenal clinician with this age, and she really does know her stuff. So I just wanted to thank her for asking me to help, but also just for her guidance and passion with this topic. Full disclosure, I'm not a parent. It's scary after doing this to think about being a parent, right? But I just wanted to give that full disclosure just because I've done a lot of work with this age group, with like sports camps and things like that. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I'm excited to learn from you guys, and I've also learned a lot just setting this presentation up. As you can see, our title here kind of explains what we want to do. We want to help you guys understand your tween, okay? We want you to kind of give you a background of where they're at developmentally. So we have the biopsychosocial development. And then we also want to give you guys some parenting techniques. Here's kind of our goals today, like I said, the biopsychosocial, spiritual, and moral development. We truly believe if we can understand what developmental stage they've come from, where they're at, and where they're going, it kind of helps us understand the issues they're facing. So we really, setting the backdrop for this is very important for us. Megan will talk some about the emotional regulation. We will have some practical parenting techniques kind of intermingled. We also will have a time for discussion after each section. So feel free to give us what you guys know and we can all talk about it. We kind of wanted this to be a dialogue. We're gonna monologue most of the time, but feel free to ask questions, give us answers to questions we don't know, and just kind of have us all learn together, okay? And then at the end, we may or may not have a group activity, we may not have time, but kind of throughout, if we could just answer the questions and things like that together. Thank you.
All right, let's start with biologically. What is going on with kids this age? So just to give you an understanding, maybe a lot of you know this, maybe you don't, brain development starts from the inside out in the back to front. So here, if you've got, when we're babies, we've got visual processing, vision development, hearing, speech, we're kind of moving forward. So kids in the tween years, we've got this movement, sensory writing, they're sort of in the middle there. That's what's going on with them in their brains. Sort of down middle where it says smell and virtual memory, that sort of starts to kick in around age 10 along with hormone and emotion. That's the limbic system area. So we kind of have a lot going on in this span of, you know, 4 or so years with kids. And, you know, each kid is different. You know, it's not like every kid at age 10 is going to do this certain thing, or, you know, we're kind of on a spectrum a little bit. So then you move forward, and at the very, you know, top of our brain there, we have the prefrontal lobe. And so we've got planning, organization, reasoning, that kind of thing. So it's cool because during ages 6 to 10, there is some good development going on in that area of the brain, but then it kind of shuts off during the teen years. So if anybody has teenagers or worked with them, I'm sure you know, the planning, the thinking ahead, it's like they have no clue. So, and that's why, because they're just not done yet. So then that area of the brain doesn't really kick in until we're back in our 20s. So full brain development, it finishes about age 25. So there's a lot going on with kids in their brains. Again, just this limbic system where we have emotion, behavior, memory, long-term memory, smell, olfaction, around age 10 is when that kicks in. So we're talking signs of puberty and that kind of thing. So yeah, just kind of what I said there, inside out, back to front, the executive function of the area, those prefrontal lobes. We have some good things going on during this time in life, in the tween years. So this is a good time for really engaging their brains, you know, trying new things, whatever they want to do, you know, like sports or cooking or, you know, I think a lot of kids during these years, they kind of initiate that, you know, I want to do this, I want to try that. So we want to engage them on that. Yeah, get that going. The emotional part of the brain starts to kick in there too. So yeah, spatial motor coordination, that's really doing well during this time. So kids are playing sports, that kind of thing. That's kind of a good time to start those things, learning new concepts, an instrument, those sort of things, for writing and mathematics. It's kind of up in the game there in those abilities. So then we've got, you know, age 10 to 12, give or take a couple years. I mean, a lot of kids age 8, we're seeing signs of puberty. So we want to have these talks with our kids even before, you know, they hit those years. We want to talk to them about body development, what's going to happen, what to expect. We want to talk about sex with our kids. We want to make sure that that's happening even before the tween years. So they're hearing it from you, and they're not hearing it from anywhere else. So we want to take this time with our kids while we've got their attention, we're engaged with them, even if they don't want to listen. You got to talk to them. We've got to have these conversations. So that's important. So this author of The Teenage Brain, I think I had a quote. Frances Jensen. I have her book up here. You can check out later. So she says, so the more activity or excitation between a specific set of neurons, the stronger the synapse. Okay, thus brain growth is a result of activity. The more a piece of information is repeated and relearned, the stronger the neurons become. The connection becomes like a well-worn path through the woods. Repetition is huge. We can't just tell our kids one thing and that's it. You know, don't have sex, or, you know, whatever it is. We have to communicate with them what's going on, and we have to do it over and over again. So it reminds me of this passage in Deuteronomy where God says, these words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. The things of God are important, right? And so he wants that repeated over and over again. Our values, the things we want our kids to know, this is the time to repeat that over and over again with our kids. Because when they get into those teen years, the attention that they have on your words is fading. So start now. So let's see, she also says the frontal lobes, like we talked about, the last area of the brain to be perfected, they're going to have difficulty thinking ahead in the teen years. We need to know that. They just don't think ahead. They don't think twice, like she says, about actions without continually inputting. So she describes, after relaying this tragic story about a teen who drowned after a night of heavy drinking, she says, how parents deal with these tragic stories and talk about them with their kids is critical. It shouldn't be, oh, wow, I'm so glad that wasn't my child. Instead, you have to be proactive. You have to stuff their mind with real stories and real consequences and over again. Just so much like the Deuteronomy passage. You know, and this is coming from a neurologist. You know, she's nothing biblical in her book or anything, but it just is so true. We've got to just over and over again repeat. So, and we can't expect our kids to initiate these conversations. So here's what to expect. I think this quote is really funny. When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished by how much he'd learn in 7 years. So that's kind of, yeah, where we're at with heading into the teen years. So at this point, are there any questions or comments? Megan? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And as adults, we forget, you know. So imagine a kid with a developing brain, you know, trying to learn new things. So yeah, over and over again. So Tony's going to talk a little bit about this section.
And I'll try my best to keep the mic. I'm not used to talking with a mic. I'm kind of expressive, so I'll try to keep the mic in front of my face here. We're going to talk about psychosocial development. There are a lot of different theories out there. Our goal here wasn't to go over all of them, but kind of pick one that kind of encompasses all the stages in one. The big thing here with Erickson, this is his stage of psychosocial development. He was moving past thinking development stopped at age like 12 or 13. So this was big news in psychology, someone showing development past the age of about 12. So that's why we're going to use him. How many have infants at home? Infants, what about 3 to 5? Awesome. And then tweens, we all have tweens, most of us. What about teens? Okay. And then we're all adults here, so, and then all of us will become older adults. So I think all of these stages will be represented in the room. And my goal is to kind of interconnect them as we go, but show the important virtue and the negative outcome of each stage. Before we get going, how many people can agree with the first one? Tweens are not equal, right? They are developing at a different rate compared to their other tweens. So an 11-year-old tween isn't developing the same rate as another 11-year-old tween. Same thing if you have your own child and then you have another child, they're not going to develop at the same rate as your first child. So I just wanted to draw attention to that before we get going, that I don't like to use the word normal, but there's a typical range. So the ranges can be large in this section. I'm sure I'm sure you guys can all attest to that with your own tweens. This may cause anxiety for parents and tweens. If you're expecting your child to be where your last child was already at 11, or if you're expecting your child to be like the neighbor kid at 11, it can cause some anxiety. And I just want to reassure you and encourage you that it's within that typical range, and there's nothing to be overly concerned about if we're in that range, just acknowledging that there is a difference here. This one is real. I like this one. May look like a teen, but act like a child. Yeah, I'm sure we can. I thought that was funny too. Just because they are 5 foot tall now and their voices are at the later ends of tweens, voices are dropping a little bit, and they're playing sports that seem physical and they seem physically like they're almost a teenager, that doesn't mean they're acting like one. So that's also not uncommon. So I'm just here to reassure you that we're in this normal range and to just have patience with them. Tweens may be cognitively advancing, but not emotionally advancing. You may have a tween who does really well in school, is acing all his or her exams, doing very well on spelling tests, but they still have tantrums, and they're still crying a lot, and they're still acting erratically. That still isn't uncommon to see the cognitive come before the emotional. And just as a way to reduce some frustration, this is typical, this is okay. And then important to treat each teen as an individual and restrain from comparing. I just think that's really important for us moving forward. So an overview of Erickson here, he believes that all mentally healthy individuals pass through these stages we're going to talk about. There's a challenge in each stage that must be confronted. However, it doesn't need to be mastered. So it's not about perfection. So when we go through the stages, if they didn't get it all the way, it doesn't mean they're not going to advance and be mentally healthy. So I just wanted to clarify that before moving forward. So we're going to start with stage one. We have trust and mistrust. This is birth to 1 year old, okay? This is where the infant is learning to trust adults. Baby cries, what do? We pick up the baby, right? Baby's hungry, what do? Feed it, okay? Baby's scared, we comfort it, right? So this is essential for their learning. They have to develop trust. They have to learn to trust adults, and they have to learn to trust their environment. They need to know that their world is predictable in order to move forward. So we have this safety versus something being unpredictable. I'm sure that we can kind of look forward and see if we're not mastering this stage, how that can cause some anxiety, where if we don't think the world is safe, we may have trouble advancing through some other stages. The virtue here is hope, hope that the world will be saved. Obviously, we can't guarantee it, but at this stage, it's really important that they have that security. So when they cry, pick them up. When they're hungry, feed them. Things that are common sense, they play a huge factor later on in development. And then this negative outcome is fear. So we want to avoid fear by increasing safety as much as we can and trust. Stage two, we have autonomy versus shame. This is the second year of life, learning that they can control their own actions, working to establish autonomy. This is kind of the bathroom stage, right? Like I do it, right? So they want to start doing things on their own. They want to know they can do that, and they're working to avoid doubting themselves. The main virtue here is will, and then the negative outcome is shame about bodies and about abilities. Now, obviously, when it comes to exploring our bodies, there has to be a balance. We can't be in this building letting our 2-year-old be naked or 3-year-old be naked. However, when they're at home exploring their bodies, that's very common, and it allows them to establish this lack of shame. So this, we don't want to be a lot of times, no, within reason, of course. We want to allow them to begin to explore themselves and their abilities. Stage three, initiative versus guilt. This is asserting control through social interaction. So this is kind of the play stage. So we're playing house, we're playing friends, we're playing church. We are interacting with our environment through play. As you can see down here, the virtue is to have a purpose, to establish who they are, and they do this through play. And I'm sure we can all relate to watching our children do this. The negative outcome is inadequacy. So if they can't do it, if we're always saying, you can't do this, or if we're doubting their abilities, they're going to form this sense of inadequacy, and we want to avoid that so we can instill a purpose in their life. So I'm skipping step four because Megan is going to talk about it. That is the stage that the tween is in. She's going to go in more detail with this, so I just wanted to skip it. So 12 to 18 is the dreaded teenage years. I'll draw on some of the people who raise their hand who have teenagers. If you can just confirm some of this that you're seeing. The main thing here is developing a sense of self. Who am I versus who the world wants me to be? And this is where most of the parental conflict comes, right? I want you to do this. No, I want to do this. I want your hairstyle to be this. No, I want it to be this. We can see this huge amount of conflict. And they're trying on different selves. I really like this concept because the work I do with parents, every time their child comes in, every time they come in and their child has tried on a new self, they are freaking out. Like, this is going to ruin their career. This is going to ruin their life. They're just trying it on. It could change weekly. It could change daily. It could change monthly. Am I with the parents of tweens? Does that sound about right? So we're really working on allowing them to develop a sense of self within the boundaries that you guys as a family create. So I'm not suggesting to have no boundaries. So set the boundaries and then let them become themselves within it. As you can see, the negative outcome of this is rebellion, and that's kind of pretty stereotypical. We tease about if you're over-controlling parents, you become rebellious. This developing a sense of self isn't really about being over-controlling, but just allowing them to explore who they are and not getting on them about being different than they are. Because they're just exploring. They may be completely different at 25 than they are trying things out at 14. I know for myself, I'm much different at 25 than the different selves I was working through at 14 to 15. We do recognize this is an extremely frustrating stage because we want the best for our kids and we don't want them to go down this road that we can see, especially when we get into some of the subculture things. But my encouragement to you is that they are just trying it on, and that if we allow them to try that on within reason, that will get them through this stage and will actually piggyback on the next stage of the must have a strong sense of self before successful intimate relationships. So this stage is extremely important to set them up for the next stage. So I'm kind of reiterating here just so we can get a sense that they are just trying themselves on, they are exploring, they are trying to figure out who they are, and a lot of times they're butting up against who they believe they're expected to be. So just kind of reiterate that, just trying on. They're trying to establish a true sense of self, and we want to avoid a rebellion. We have stage 6, this is 19 to 40. This is where we share our lives with others. So the intimacy doesn't just mean romantically, it means friendships of all kinds. So this intimacy, let's extend it past romance and establishing good friend groups and good family networks, and that's gonna move into kind of where we're at now is we're kind of in this stage, I'm assuming, a lot of us, this 19 to 40. So we are trying to do this as our kids are trying to find themselves. So do we see kind of the conflict, right? Like if I'm 37, I'm trying to get my network connected, but my tween is trying to push away from my network. So I think that's why it causes a lot of that conflict, because typically the stage the parent is in is the opposite goal of what the tween is in. So just being aware that's kind of the stage we're in, and it's all kind of typical. The virtue here is love, and then the negative outcome is isolation and unhappiness is what we're trying to avoid. We want to avoid being lonely, and we do that by establishing our social networks, our partner, our family, our friends, our kids. Stage 7, we have age 40 to 65, finding one's life work. So this is where we are really trying to find our purpose in life, and we're really trying to establish what do I contribute now, and what will I contribute to the next generation? Also see a lot of conflict when you're in this age, raising tweens and teens, because you want to contribute to the next generation. So you want to raise your child the best you can so he or she can contribute to the next generation. But what are they trying to do? They're trying to be themselves. So that's where we're getting a lot of this conflict. If we don't feel like we're contributing, we don't think that we're contributing, and we aren't finding our purpose, whether through work or through family or through hobbies or whatever that looks like through church, we may struggle with this belief that we haven't left our mark on society. So we're trying to establish care, and we're trying to avoid being unproductive in this stage. Last stage here, we have 65 plus. This is where we start to reflect on our life. I think we see this a lot, where there's a lot of passing down of family items, a lot of really looking back and saying, what did I do? And hopefully if we did well in this stage, we can reflect on this positively. So I think if we can see how the stages are stacking up together, if this stage doesn't get complete, this stage is hard to complete, and this stage is hard to complete. That's why I just wanted to show all of the stages to show how they really do build on each other. The virtue here, the goal here is to lack regrets versus bitterness and depression. We actually see a spike in depression, 65 plus. So, and this can be related to that. We're looking for wisdom versus disappointment.
So I did want to just reemphasize all the stages of development, and one, to consider that there's always a challenge at every stage of development to overcome. So even at the stage of development you are in as parents, you are working through a challenge of overcoming something, and so is your child. So at this stage, what kids are trying to overcome is feelings of being inferior. So they're trying to identify where they can make a contribution. How do they fit into the world around them? So the challenge here is to be industrious. You know, so inferior feelings set in when the child is unable to accomplish something that they believe is important to the world around them. So sports, that kind of thing. If they are viewing that as something that's important to accomplish, then they're going to feel inferior if they're not doing well in that area. So they become more aware of the world around them. They start comparing themselves to other kids, other people they see everywhere, you know, TV, whatever. That's what's going on in their minds. How do I measure up? What can we do about that, though, as parents, knowing that our kid is trying to find their way here to become industrious? How do they measure up? What can we do? Well, we can certainly encourage all the attempts for industry, right? So if you have a tween right now, you're probably seeing things like lots of lemonade stands, or you're seeing, I want to try to hold a bake sale for this cause or something and raise money to help shelter pets, or, you know, they're coming to you with lots of different interests and trying their hand at different things. And so as parents, we really want to play that up. So instead of saying something like, I don't think that's going to work, which is probably what you really want to say, like, nobody's going to come buy your lemonade. We live on a cul-de-sac, you know. So instead of that, it's great. How can I help? Let's do this. So it's a lot of work for us, right? You know, we kind of think in this stage, we're out of early childhood. We can coast for a little while, take your foot off the gas pedal, but really it's just entering into another stage and life just looks a little bit different. I'm going to emphasize this more in a different section, but we gotta limit screen time, because if that device is in between your kid and what's out here and what they could be doing, it's just going to hinder their development. So we've got to set limits on screen time to allow their brains to think, to imagine, to work, to figure out where they're fitting in, what they're good at, what they like to do, that kind of thing. So yeah, success in school is another thing. These are the dogged school years, you know, one grade after the other. And how do I measure up? Am I doing well in school, or do I feel inferior to other people? With unsuccessful resolution, so they can adopt these negative core beliefs about self. Am I incompetent? Am I stupid? What does this mean? So we're looking for attempts your child makes at trying something new. Like I said, we want to emphasize the success there. A good example of this, my daughter, my oldest, started playing the violin at age 8. And we had no idea that the violin is the hardest instrument to learn, but she did it and she started learning, but man, that was really hard. And there were so many times she wanted to give up and felt that she was inferior, you know, but we just kept encouraging. And then when she gets to learning a harder piece, remember when you were saying how hard this was? Look at how far you've come. So we want to have times in our kids' lives that we can hone in on and remind them, look at what you've done, look at what you've accomplished. So really building up that encouragement. I love saying this to my kids. They've heard it a million times. There are very few things in life worth doing that are not hard. So I say this a lot. It's so true. I think kids a lot, I mean, especially in our culture now, is we're looking for the easy way out. You know, we want comfort. We don't want to work hard. So we want to help our kids understand that doing something hard is great. Look at what you can do. Look at what your mind can do. This is so exciting. So we want to help our kids enter into doing hard things. You know, yeah, I wanted to give up the violin too. That was not fun. But we're entering into doing something hard, and this is going to pay off. My kids love to hear stories of when I was their age. They just adore that. So as much as you can come up with, you know, gosh, I remember when I was your age and I, whatever, you know, that really helps them feel at ease and secure that you know what they're going through. You understand this stage that they're in. So any questions or anything anybody wants to say at this point? Yeah. Right. Yeah. So can I ask, is God involved in your life? Okay, so we want to hone in on, you know, God's involvement in our life. And this Creator God created you beautifully. You are wonderfully made. We want to emphasize that as much as we can. And so we all have imperfections and struggles. We all do. And everybody around you does too. So having conversations like that, and every kid is different. They're all going to develop at different rates. Even if we didn't have things like ADHD or any other developmental disabilities going on. So yeah, I think even with ADHD, there are things that you are good at and that you can do. Let's find what you're good at, what you like to do. Let's do it. Does that help at all? Are you okay? Something else? Yeah. I don't work with ADHD at all, so that's not my wheelhouse, so you know, do you have a pointer? Yeah. And if you have specifics too, we can talk after. Yeah. Uh-huh. I would say sign him up and tell him he's gonna do it. Yeah, I think it does. Yeah, I really do encourage that, you know, to, you know, if we're trying something new, you can pick this or this, you know. Sports, that's fine. You don't have to play a sport. Let's do a cooking class, you know. Let's see. We want to have exposure to where we're seeing, we're trying something hard, and then we're finishing, and wow, look what I did. Sachs, in one of his books, makes reference to parents of a kid who was playing Madden football and just constant video games and had no desire to play a real sport at all. And they signed him up and put him in football anyway. And they listened to some complaints, but he finished and at the end said, "Wow, real football is so much better than." You know, online football, but the, you know, I guess the task there for the parent is, you know, we're going to stick this through, and I know it's hard, but it's going to be hard. So that would be my advice. Yeah.
I've worked with people, it's like the opposite, who they only want to do sports. So instead of signing them up for a league that is like 10 weeks long and it's a huge commitment, at first maybe just take them to the park as a family and start make it a family activity just to get them introduced to it before you go to, I'm going to sign you up for a league you've never played before, you don't know how it works. He could have some anxiety, he or she could have some anxiety, I'm not adequate enough, right, I'm not capable. So if you kind of introduce it to them as a family, even just on a Saturday at the park, I think that's a good way to kind of kickstart that. And they may not like it, but if you guys are playing basketball or kicking a soccer ball, hopefully you'll model that behavior and he'll join in. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of kickstart him instead of just throwing him in the deep end. I've seen that work with parents, kind of slowly, and do it as a family. I think he or she, I don't know, I'm sorry, I think they would enjoy doing that as a family as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and hone in on what he likes too. Mm-hmm. You know, if he likes Legos, let's go look for a Lego club. You know, let's do something different, new, that kind of thing. Anything else? Right. You have some really good things to say. I wonder how so-and-so feels when you tell him what to do. I wonder if you could put that in a different way. You know, that kind of conversation. So when we get into emotional development, kind of talk about empathy. So learning empathy for kids, that's a task, but we want to put them in situations where they are realizing what the other person is going through. So, yeah, you're right, you know, he probably shouldn't be taking a cookie, you know, but, you know, whose job is that? So you can encourage and say, you're right, but that kind of thing. But we'll get into that more, too. Yeah.
So just to piggyback off of what she said, just acknowledging that that assertiveness is part of her personality. Mm-hmm. It's normal personality. Now we have to guide it, right? So a recommendation I just thought of is maybe get a project for her to lead, right? Like, it could be something small. Get this project done. I'm trying to think of something. So maybe getting cookies for a bake sale, right? Your job is to do this project. And that would allow her to use her assertiveness, which isn't a bad thing, it's just a normal personality, in a constructive way. So maybe some intentional things that she can boss, right, or lead. And that's an add-on to what she said, not in replacing of it. Mm-hmm. So maybe just create an event for her to take charge of and let her complete that.
Yeah, and it's not going to squash a kid's spirit to know that they have, things to work on, you know, and then that's okay. Yeah. Anybody else? Oh, that's me again. Good. Okay. Okay, so things we want to talk about with emotional development. We want to flesh out what emotional intelligence is. You've probably heard that phrase, those words around. What is emotional regulation? What is meta-emotion? We have that, so we'll get into that. And then I'm going to explain how to act from the wise mind. So emotional intelligence for parents, it means being aware of your child's feelings, being able to empathize, soothe, and then guide them. But for children, it means the ability to control impulses, delay gratification, motivate self, read other people's cues, cope with life's ups and downs. That's a huge task for kids. So in essence, when you have emotional intelligence, you're aware of feelings. You can display an ability to empathize, ability to control impulses, delay gratification, motivate self, read other people's social cues. And empathy is different than sympathy. So we need to remember, so empathy is actually moving into that other person's world of feelings and kind of putting yourself there and feeling what they're feeling. Sympathy is just standing back and saying, that's too bad. You know, that's too bad they're going through that. I feel for you. But empathy is feeling what they're feeling. It's a whole different level. I'm not going to get into this too much unless anybody has questions, but in the clinical world with kids, we see higher and higher diagnoses of depression, bipolar disorder in kids this age, and that's really unfortunate. Kids this age will have mood swings. They will struggle with their emotions. That's going to happen. So I think that wise parents will seek help when things seem unmanageable, but certainly ask questions if you have specifics with that. So we can teach our kids to regulate their emotions. We can be a student of our children, of our child, and look for what happens to them when they get anxious. What is going on when they're angry? So one of my children will remain nameless, but we were getting ready for a trip recently, and the week, even 2 weeks leading before, I was just questions about, what are we going to do when we get there, and how are we getting there, and what, you know, what's going to happen to the dog, and, you know, just constant questions, and it was really irritating me. But I clued in and thought, I wonder if she's worried about something. So, you know, I'm wondering, you're asking me a lot of questions. Are you worried about something? Tears. Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm, worried about this and that. So just paying attention to what's going on with them. They're not going to express the emotion. They're not going to say a whole lot, I'm feeling sad, I'm worried, you know, whatever. So we want to just be mindful of what's going on. You know, when kids get angry, or, you know, do they get all red in the face, clench their fists, stomp around? You know, I'm sure you've noticed that through early childhood. That happens a lot. What goes on with them when they're feeling different things? So our family lives are our first school for emotional learning. So here's just some ideas. I like this. This is from Gottman as well, who had, John Gottman is a psychologist who's had 40 plus years of research on marriage and family and children and emotion. He wrote a great book up here, Raising the Emotionally Intelligent Child. Anyway, I love this. So let's replace some of our instant responses with our kids to things like these empathetic statements. Gosh, that sounds scary. Tell me about that. This must be hard for you. So kind of learning a new way to converse with our child when they feel emotional. I can completely sympathize with, we have busy lives as parents. You know, we have lots of kids. I have three kids. I work. It's really hard to sit down and just take the time to do something like this, but it really pays off. Any questions on that so far? Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's where our patience really gets challenged.
So when they're in the tantrum stage, so in my office, I talk about getting flooded a lot. So if you're familiar with that term, emotionally flooded, just means that you are so emotionally, your emotions are so high, and all these physical things are going on, your blood pressure's high, your heart rate's high, you physically can't take in any more cognitive information. It's not going to help to talk with your child when they're tantruming. So yeah, you can say, you seem upset right now. I'm going to walk away. You let me know when you need something. And then you just repeat that over and over again. You know, we're not quite ready yet. I'm going to walk away. You let me know. That kind of thing. I did want to say on here, so, okay. We've got some different parenting styles here. I think it's good to kind of look and see where you tend. Are you more on the permissive side, the authoritative? Are you uninvolved, authoritarian? And this goes along with what meta-emotion is, and that really is just our thoughts and feelings about feelings. Just like our kids are learning emotions from family life, we too learned how to think about emotion from our families. So was anger okay to express in your home? You know, was crying okay? Those kinds of things. So we go into parenting with these meta emotions, and our kids present this tantrum and a lot of anger, a lot of crying. How do we respond? Can we handle it? Do we yell at them for expressing it? You know, that kind of thing. So we want to have a idea of how we think about emotions. So here's some things that Gottman says about helping kids through becoming an emotion coach. He talks about emotion coaching parents, becoming aware of their emotion, recognizing the emotion as an opportunity for intimacy and teaching. I love that. It's completely reframing how we think about this tantrum, you know, how we think about their outburst or the snide remark that they make to their sibling, that kind of thing. It's an opportunity for diving into that, using some empathy, and finding out what's going on. What are they thinking? Maybe there's some core beliefs down there about themselves that they're believing that are completely untrue, and this is an opportunity to unravel that and talk about that. So listening empathetically, validating their feelings. We all have feelings, and feelings are good, and they're okay, you know. Yeah, I could see why that would make you mad. I get it. Help them to find words to label that emotion, exploring strategies to solve the problem. Gottman talks about good emotion coaching parents not only empathize, but also help their kids find strategies to, well, what can we do about it? What's the next step? So parents teach children about emotion in two categories, those who give their children guidance about the world of emotion and those who don't. So children get their cues on handling emotion from parents, teach our kids what to think about emotion by our actions, what we say or don't say. And that gets passed down over generations. I'm sure that you can think about how what it was like in your home growing up about emotions. So when we start to understand our own thoughts and feelings about emotion, we can help them create a healthy way of dealing with theirs. So a lot of times we can have a tendency to protect our kids from experiencing negative emotion. We want to just jump in there and fix it, you know, and not help them to learn how to move through this themselves and solve it themselves. So emotion coaching parents give kids tools for their future relationships, really. So you can even look at it that way, that you're really setting the groundwork for their future marriages, their future relationships one day, and even just in their relationships with their friends and peers. So what are the results of kids who have emotion coaching at home? They're better able to soothe themselves, they bounce back from distress, even better physical health, and they score higher academically. Again, Gottman has done years and years of research. This isn't just, you know, guessing. This is research on kids from who receive this type of emotion coaching. So we can protect kids from harmful effects of marital conflict and divorce. They've found that even kids from homes where their parents are divorced, when they receive emotion coaching, they did just as well. So it's really important to have this type of thing going on with your child. And I love this too, you know, by adopting this type of emotion coaching with your kids, you have an emotional bond with your child, and that's so important because you are creating what we're going to get into in a little bit, influence on your child. You're having this influence on your child. Your words matter to them, and they care about what you think. So you're really creating a strong bond for the future with them. We do this really fun thing with kids this age to talk about emotion and reasoning. So we take a glass container and we label the rocks as our reasonable or reasoning thoughts and the sand as our emotion. And so we pile the rocks inside the container and then we dump sand in as the emotion. And we see, gosh, it all fits so nicely. We've got reasoning thoughts and we have emotions. What happens when we put the sand in first? So we put all the emotion in the container and oh, there's not very many reasoning thoughts that fit in there. So we try to illustrate with them that you've got thoughts that are reasoning thoughts, reasonable, logical facts. And that's God-given and that's good. And you've got emotion, which is the same. It's wonderful. We want to have our emotions. But when we make decisions, when we have actions based on just reason or just emotion, it doesn't turn out very well. But if we learn how to combine the two, it goes together really well. So that's a fun thing even to do at home with your kids when you're going through some trying times. Right. Rocks first, then sand. Right. Right, because you're too filled up with the emotion to have any reasonable thoughts. Yeah, this is fun. I like this illustration. We've got a plan for our kids, but it doesn't really happen that way or go as smoothly as we expect. This is a great model to use to illustrate what's going on now with parenting. We're moving out of the early childhood years, okay? So saying no to things isn't going to cut it as much. You know, our direct authority on them, they're getting smart. They're not going to take it like they used to. You can't just put them in timeout and that kind of thing. Yeah. So we've got some fun illustrations here. Yeah. So our parenting tactics from early child are becoming less effective. The no is going to lose its luster. You're going to endure the pushback, the sarcastic remarks that come from nowhere that shock you. They start to do and say things that
you've never heard come out of their mouth before. It will definitely surprise you. So if you're using an authority-only model in parenting, they're going to resort to other resources of influence around them. And then if you're using an influence-only, then they're going to feel confused and insecure. So we have to figure out how to have a good balance between the two. Another great book, Parenting with Love and Logic, Klein and Fay, demands and threats may yield short-term results. You might get some behavior change, but they're not going to mold our kids' minds and teach them values. And this is funny.
And the beauty of it is you're never safe. So take this, for example. Looks pretty innocent, but what am I going to do? Am I going to whip up some eggs? Or am I going to whip some ass? Or this. Am I going to dry some dishes? Or am I going to dry some tears? Your turn.
Am I going to fry some bacon? Or am I going to cave your skull in?
Yes, lesson over. What have I done?
I like that show. I think that's funny. But yeah, just to illustrate, you know, the authority only when they're that age, they're going to come back with some good ones and they're going to confuse you. And okay, I need a different tactic here. So we need structure. We need rules. That's important in a family. We want to have those. So one of the handouts that I put over there, if you grabbed it, is a family crest. That is really fun to do as a family with your kids. It can be really healing also if your family has experienced any kind of trauma or divorce or anything that's just disrupted the family, and even great if not. But we want to talk with our kids as a family, parent-led conversations about what do we value? What should our family rules be? What are we about as a family? We've got to have our homes having rules that we're treating each other respectfully. We're treating our homes respectfully, that kind of thing. We want to have us safe, and we want to have others safe and healthy. Klein and Fay again, responsibility cannot be taught, it must be caught. So as parents, modeling things like this, doing fun family activities like that is really good. So another resource that I cite at the end, there is a wonderful website called the Family Dinner Project, and it was created by a Harvard grad. It is phenomenal. It has family dinner conversation topics for every age group, every stage, recipes and meal planning. You can sign up for weekly emails, that kind of thing. What our family does is I wrote down on note cards a whole bunch of different questions from their website, conversation topics. We put it in a bag and we pass it around the dinner table, and everybody picks one, and we have great conversations about really meaningful things, about values, about friendship. It's such a great tool. It's right there in front of you. It's like doing the work, the conversation work for you. So I highly recommend that kind of thing. So we need to give our kids an opportunity for being reasonable, right? Setting rules, letting them choose to follow through. A consequence when a rule is not followed will help them catch that responsibility. An important rule we'll get into later on too, but electronic devices need to be used in a public place in your home. So they should not be used in a bedroom with a closed door, that kind of thing. But we'll get into that later as well. Just being on guard to not withhold love as a consequence. It can be an easy trap to get into as a parent. In reality, the interaction between parents and children, the expression of love, is far more important than the kid's success or failure. That's just so important. Our interactions, our expression of love to our kids has such great, great influence on them for their entire lives. Just practically, we want to just identify your core need with a rule, and then where can you bend on that? We want to have the room cleaned over the weekend, but does it need to be
done on Saturday. Well, it could be done by dinner time Sunday, that's fine. Reframing conversations to reflect their experience. It sounds like you might feel overwhelmed, that kind of thing. Let me know if I can help. Position of influence with our children when we don't bend the rules for them, but we do force them to follow the rules. When we allow them to experience the situation and assess what will happen, we gain their respect. Remember our own thoughts about emotions. Yeah, Love and Logic, I highly recommend. This is the book for older kids, but also their website is a huge tool. They have weekly emails that just give you parenting tips and that kind of thing. But knowing that as they get older, their source of influence becomes wider. You know, Sack says, in American culture today, same age peers matter more than parents, and parents are reluctant to change the rules, to insist, for example, that time with family is more important than time with same age peers. Their source of influence is becoming greater. We need to stand on being those main influencers in their lives. Yeah. And again, the tween years, we have our child's attention right now, and that's not going to last much longer. So take advantage of this time. They're impressionable now. We want to be the ones making the impression on them. We want to be the influencer in their life. Any questions? Anything on that? Like an appropriate consequence? Yeah. To the action. Yeah. It is. Sure. Right. Yeah. I mean, unless there's a specific, you know, but have you, this book is really good. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of times it is a lot of same thing over and over again, especially with sibling rivalry and arguing and that kind of thing. You know, they have a lot to say on all that stuff. So I would highly recommend that book. You're sort of wondering how much influence do we have with our kids when most of their time is spent out of the home, at school. Am I hearing you right? Okay. Yeah. I know. We got to make the most of our time with them, you know, and just taking an opportunity to bring up those conversations and what would you do if, you know, or tell me about who are your friends at school? What's, you know, just trying to dialogue as much as we can about that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I know. And I think we'll get into, I really do want to spend some time on just their culture and what they are exposed to.
We have a lot of information to kind of get to in the next 25 minutes, so I'm going to kind of highlight some stuff. We're more than happy to send this to you if you write your email down, because I don't think we're going to get to everything. I would like to touch on everything, but I don't think we're going to get to everything in as much detail as we wanted. So feel free to write down your email, and we can be in contact with you guys. These first two lines are kind of funny to me when I wrote them down, because remembering kids face similar challenges, yet they're unique. So they're the same, but they're not. And it's kind of funny, but I think it's true in the sense that they have the same challenges. They're just working through them in a unique time. So just having that in mind, first generation, so 1995 to now, first generation to always have access to their computers. That's more true the later we go, obviously, but they were born into their smartphone. Not literally, obviously, but they were born into, this is how they see their world. So it's the conflict, I see it all the time, where you're on your phone too much, and yes, screen time is a huge problem, but the reason why they're on their phone so much is because this is how they get everything. Their news, their relationships, even their learning. I know in schools they're giving laptops and they're giving tablets. And it's, I see at the bottom, I wrote disadvantages of advantages. It's one of my favorite concepts. I use it with clients all the time. Basically, I think we can deduce every advantage has a disadvantage. And being able to work through those disadvantages. So I really like Megan's advice of limiting screen time or having the screen time be when you're in the room. So we don't have to say you don't get to have relationships online. It's that you're having them on, you can have them online, but they need to be during this time, setting boundaries, and also with the family. And I know this kind of, I don't want to say with the family, avoiding family time, but just making sure that we understand this is how they are viewing their world. And when we are coming in to say something different, that we are coming right up against all they know. So I think setting good boundaries as soon as possible, we can set the dialogue of what they know. And I think it's important to be aware that this is all they know unless we tell them something else. So just an encouragement to start that as soon as possible. This is your phone, but then this is our family. This is dinner time, this is your phone. So just really separating those things, knowing that this is just how they view their world. I like the modeling the phone behavior. I'm not suggesting that you have to follow all the rules your kids follow, but with these big things, if you say no phones at the table, model that behavior for them. It's going to be very confusing to them if you say no phones at the table and they see you on your phone. So just really important to model that behavior. If there's no phone during family time, then no phone during family time. Just so that the modeling is huge, so they can see the behavior that you are expecting from them. So I think we kind of talked about this. I wanted to highlight some of the listening and the Carl Rogers and the building rapport. First, we have the listening to respond versus listening to understand. I'm sure we can all relate to this. Really want to stress doing this with our spouses, doing this with our kids, but also being intentional about telling our kids to do these things. So if you tell that they're jumping in with something, maybe step back and say, did you actually hear what I have to say? It sounds like you were waiting for me to stop talking to say what you're already going to say. So changing this listening to respond to listening to understand. I don't remember. I didn't come up with this. I don't remember who said this, but someone had told me this, and I really like it. The working to understand before being understood. So if we kind of make that little adjustment of what is this person saying to me and with our kids? What is my kid saying to me? They may not be as articulate as we are, but they're saying something. So what are they saying? Try to understand that before you're trying to make them understand you. I think you'll be able to address it more effectively if you kind of have a more understanding of where they're coming from. We have, with Carl Rogers, we have the empathy. This is just a simple empathy statement. It seems like you feel blank, so an emotion. So it seems like you feel frustrated because you're not getting to go outside. One of the biggest things in counseling that changed the way that I think and communicate is a lot of times we say the word feel like. I feel like, and then we insert a thought, right? So I feel like no one likes me. I feel like I'm not good at anything. What we really mean is we feel frustrated because we think nobody likes me. So just that simple tweak, I think, really helps with the empathy. And you're going to know, I'm going to say it a lot. You guys are going to notice it. We all do it. And we say, I feel like. But what we're doing is we're not using emotions. We're using feel, but we're not saying an emotion. So this simple switch, I think, has done a lot for me personally. And I know it's a big staple of Carl Rogers and changing how we approach that. So it seems like you feel, insert an emotion, because why you think they're feeling the emotion. And doing that with them and also teaching them to do that. If you hear your child saying, I just feel like this isn't fair, maybe slow them back and say, let's attach an emotion to that. And if they say, I'm angry. So it seems like you're angry because you're not getting what you want. And that little switch really does help them communicate how they're feeling, but it also helps us communicate how we're feeling if it's just with our spouses or with other people. So I think it's just a good, simple, it doesn't always have to be as scripted, right? But the fact that we're saying feel and emotion and then the reason. This unconditional positive regard, this is very difficult. It's easier for me to tell you this, and it's easy for me to do this with my clients because I'm not emotionally attached to them to the degree that you are emotionally attached to your children. So to say that you have to accept everything your child does is not realistic, and I'm not going to suggest that it is. I just want us to think about this condoning versus condemning concept. If you accept your child for what they value, what they think, what they're doing, that doesn't mean you're condoning the behavior. So I just really wanted to bring a distinction between the condoning versus condemning, and do more condoning than condemning, and just realize that they need this unconditional non-judgment from us because they want it, and they're going to get it from somewhere. And I really think if we get it from our parents, it really, for one, it enhances that bond between child and family, but it allows them to say, whoever I am, my mom, my dad, they love me for me. And I think that seems simplistic, but it has a lot of value. I know a lot of work that I do, especially in the later adolescence, the amount of times I hear, I just don't think my parents like me. I don't think my parents love me. I don't know why I can't make my parents happy. All of these things. So just shifting our thoughts to this unconditional positive regards. I love you because you are my child. I don't agree with what you're doing, but I still love you. And that's simple. I wish I could stress how significant that simple thing is, because early adult, I see a lot of early adult clients, and it's amazing how many of them don't know their parents love them because they disagreed with their actions. So condemning and condoning. And just remember, they're teenagers. They're just trying out new things. This too shall pass, right? That's the saying. We talked about flooding. I won't spend a lot of time. I just will add this 20 minutes. That's a recommended time that it takes to become unflooded. So with, I think someone back here had the example. If you are flooded, either with your spouse or with your child, and you're actually saying, okay, we need time apart, 20 minutes is kind of the minimum. It can be longer, but any shorter than 20 minutes, you're not going to be, your emotions aren't going to be reduced enough to actually move forward with the rational thinking with that. I'm just going to kind of look to see what I want to highlight here. Just being stable with your kids, modeling. I do this a lot with married couples. This coming together versus pulling apart. So a lot of times mom will come up with a rule or dad will come up with a rule, and when the kids are fighting back and say, mom told you to do this, dad told you to do this. I just want to work on us changing that language to, we want you to do this. This is our rule. And allowing your kids to know that you guys are on the same team. I don't have to tell this to you guys. Kids are really good at manipulating us. They are really good at it. And this is something that day one with married couples having any issues with their children, you're on the same team. Your kids will divide you and conquer if it means they don't get punished. So just this language, it's nothing major, just switching this language of, this is what we've decided, these are our rules. And I think that simple switch will at least give some stability, and it kind of stops that, well, mom said no, so I'm gonna run to dad, and then dad can say, well, you know, that's our rule as well. So just that simple switch in language, I think, does a lot. We've really touched on this. I just wanna highlight this and encourage you. I kind of made a list of people who are communicating with your teen, sources of information. That's a lot, and only one of them is us. So that's scary. I put parents on the top on purpose. I really want you guys to feel encouraged to have the conversations that need to be had. The thought of, if I don't tell my kids, they're not gonna know it, with the internet is long gone. They're open to the entire world that we are with their phones. They have access to YouTube, which has everything you could imagine. If they want to know something, they can find it. This is a great time to set the narrative for your guys' family and for your kids, because if they're not happy with your answer, they can go somewhere else. So I just want to encourage you to have the tough conversations, knowing that if when they leave, their interest in that conversation isn't going away. And there are some positive people on here, but when we get down to the internet, the pop stars, reality TV stars, I wouldn't want my children getting introduced to a topic that way. So just, it's not too early to have some of these difficult conversations, because if we don't, someone will be. So just some encouragement there. We're gonna talk about these topics. Sorry, I made this a little small. I'll try to read them. Can everyone see this? I apologize, I made it a little small. So the warning signs of bullying, just not wanting to go to school, if they're constantly, I don't feel well, I don't want to go to school, if it's a trend, just be aware of it. I'm not suggesting that everyone who doesn't want to go to school is being bullied. These are just some signs, just be aware of them. Making excuses as to why people bully them. Well, I did this, so I get why he did it. Or, I did that, I did this. Pay attention to that. It's a warning sign that someone is making them feel like a victim. So just obviously unexplained bruises, the kids, they get them. I just added that, you know, if they're always having bruises on their shoulders or something, just be aware of these things and be able to address them. being the bully. It's sad, but eventually one of our kids is going to be a bully. And I think just addressing that by doing some of the empathy statements, introducing them to how your actions are making someone else feel is very important. No one wants to raise a bully. No one wants to think that their kid is a bully. But just be aware if you see them bullying people that it's okay to have the conversation with them about the other person's emotions here. This in-person bullying versus cyberbullying. People tell me this all the time. They say, back in the day, if you got bullied at school and you came home, it was over. We don't live there anymore. So just being aware, if they're being bullied online, you have the ability to remove that source of bullying from them. I know that we really are in this stage of the cell phone being a necessity versus a privilege. We'll talk about a little later. But if you're noticing all this online bullying, you remove that from them and work through them so they're not getting that 12 hours a day of being bullied, 6 hours at school, 6 hours at home. So just be aware that we're in those times where people will say things online that they won't say to your face. I think we've all been on Facebook message boards, and we can attest that people don't talk like that face-to-face. So this is happening to them. Even if we don't think it's happening at 8, it is happening. I just wanted to highlight here this unintentional. I would never suggest that we're intentionally bullying our children, but just think about how talking down to their abilities, oh, you're not good at that, oh, why are you doing that? It's not building their self-confidence. They're just being aware, criticizing their things they come up with. Oh, that's dumb. Oh, that's stupid. Oh, that won't work. Really, just try to instill some self-confidence in them so they can handle the outside world. Like I said, I would never suggest that it was intentional. But sometimes we can intentionally be talking down to our kids just because we think at a higher level than they do. Their way of fixing the TV, we may know that will never work. But to them, that's what they know. So just be encouraging with them and avoid talking down. The self-confidence and self-doubt. We've talked about focusing on strengths. Putting our energy into strengths. Where I'm not perfect. None of us are perfect. None of us are going to be. And if my child is really good at music, or if my child is really good at school and struggles with the opposite, so I'm not good at sports, but I'm good at school, put your energy into school. Allow them to get really good at what they're good at instead of being somewhat mediocre at a lot of things. Really hone in on what is my child good at and how can I make them the best that they can be, because that will instill some self-confidence in them. So I'm just going to touch on this as an up-and-coming concern. Just be aware of it. Start the conversation. Have the open dialogue. If you don't tell them, if you don't have these conversations, they are seeing drug use on the internet, TV. So chemical addiction isn't very common at this age, but it's something they're moving into. So just be aware of that as we move forward. The process addiction. So these are behavioral addictions. So these are video games, food. Megan's actually going to talk a lot about the video games, so I'll kind of gloss over that. I will say that it's not currently a diagnosis. Everyone is saying that it's going to be in the next edition of the DSM, but currently it's not. They're doing a lot of research with that, and she has a slide for that. Back to the disadvantage of advantages, video games do allow kids to do imaginative play, which is good. Allows them to expand their creativity, and it helps them develop their personality. We just want to make sure that we're doing so in a realistic and a controlled manner, so they're not developing any sort of addictions with their gaming device. And then just establishing good habits with the screen time. We'll move to some positive reinforcement things as we go here. Just kind of to touch on this, and these are the signs of child and adolescent depression. The ones that are italicized and bolded are the ones that you typically see in the child, so our age between that we're talking about. The significant changes in appetite, the unexplained aches and pains, and the social withdrawals. I understand that the top two can be explained by just growing, but if you see this as a pattern, be aware of it and get it checked out. As you can see, a third of adults who are diagnosed with depression had symptoms in childhood. So this is the 8 to 12 range. So that's significant. And luckily, we live in a society where mental health we have more awareness and we have more resources. So just getting them those resources when they need them. I have this no shame here. Just kind of a personal note. I experienced a lot of shame when I was a kid, so I really connect with this sense of who am I, why, what is wrong with me, and I really wanted us to avoid shame talking. If our child had diabetes or if our child got cancer, we don't treat it like something's wrong with them. So I just encourage you with your own kids and other kids that mental illness is a legitimate disease, and it's something that affects a lot of people. And just avoiding the shame, early detection, early treatment is the best way to avoid long-term consequences with mental illness. So if you're noticing these patterns, just reach out, and there's a lot of resources, especially in Columbus. I will touch on this really quick. We kind of talked about it with the thoughts and feelings. So our thoughts dictate how we feel, and that dictates how we behave. I would like to go more into this, but I think we need to continue. Like I said, I'm welcome to give you these slides.
I just wanted everybody to react a little bit to this picture. Just look at it and tell me what you think. Any emotional reaction? What are they doing? Yeah. You don't know. Any other thoughts? Yeah, good. Maybe thinking. No idea. Don't know what to do. This is what most every teenager does when they get home from school at night. They sleep with their phones. Their phones are a part of them. This is what happens. This is teenage American life right there. Laying in bed, and you have no clue where your kid is. They're there in your home, but you don't know where they're at. And I really, really want to emphasize the internet. They are exposed to anything and everything all the time. We have become a culture of parents that is so overprotective. We talk about the helicopter parents. You know, we're watching their every move on the playground when they're little. If we take them to the mall, they're with a friend, check back in 10 minutes, you know. But when they're on their phones and their devices, we have no clue where they're at. And it's just, this is a real passion of mine. I really see, and so many experts agree, that our devices, and with adults included, have really interrupted development, our relationships, that kind of thing. There is some difference between boys and girls with that. I really love Sachs's book, Girls on the Edge, and he also has Boys Adrift. It talks about girls and social media. That's huge for them. I also wanted to, maybe a couple of you were at this not too long ago. We had the Franklin County Task Force for Internet Crimes Against Children here to do an internet safety training. It was very eye-opening, but they had said bringing up different social media sites and affirming, which I knew, Snapchat was created for the intention to distribute pornographic material. That is why Snapchat was created. We need to know things like that. That's why messages disappear. Okay, it's not like that as much anymore, but know that that's the intent of these types of sites. There's social media sites like Kick and Omegle where kids and anybody can go on anonymously, and it's for the intention of distributing pornographic material, for hooking up, that kind of thing. And this is starting at this age. I mean, kids as young as 8 years old being sent pictures of other naked kids, asking for pictures of them to be sent. We really need to be aware, as uncomfortable as it is, that this is going on. We have to have these conversations with our kids. It's just, it's a different generation. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, so the way that I communicated with my friends was on a mustard-colored rotary phone hanging on the wall with a really long cord. I mean, that was the extent of freedom I got with talking with my friends, and times have definitely changed. For boys, video games are huge. Why? Because it leads them into this fantasy world where they can be great. For years, this is from Sachs's book, Sony's lead advertising line for the PS4 was, "Greatness awaits." The actor looking directly into the camera says, "Who are you to be ordinary? Who are you to be anonymous? You whose name should be spoken in reverent tones or with terrified whispers." Man, that's awful. And that's what the draw is for these kids. Things like first-person, you know, shooter games, in my opinion, should not be allowed at all. Your kids should not be playing that. It's just prone for violence and addiction. Yes, the DSM is considering gaming addiction in the next edition. And these are the signs of addiction. We got preoccupation with internet games. They do go through withdrawal symptoms when it's taken away. Irritability, anxiety. Tolerance needs to go up and up, increasing amounts of game use. Unsuccessful attempts to control use, loss of interest in other hobbies, that kinds of things. We need to be aware of that kind of thing. Yeah, oh, this is great. Being a parent in the United States today means doing things differently from your neighbors. Just because society and our culture says this is what your kids should be doing, you should have a smartphone at age 7, that kind of thing, it doesn't mean that we give our kids that. We need to be different than our culture. Yeah, our culture just tells us our kids need the latest and greatest, and seriously, they're going to be okay without it.
We obviously prepared too much, but in terms, I want to get to the reinforcement. So this is discipline styles, things like that. So we have, I'll try to explain this in 5 minutes, and then we'll let you guys go. So with, in terms of discipline, we have reinforcement, which is anything that increases the likelihood of behavior, right? And then we have punishment, which is to decrease. So positive is not good or bad. Positive is adding something to increase behavior or adding something to decrease behavior. Same thing with punishment. So we are adding something to decrease behavior or removing something to decrease behavior. So practically, so let's just look at a non-parenting thing. So if the target behavior is safe driving, reinforcement, a positive, would be a gift card. If you drive safe, I will give you a gift card, right? The negative is, so our cars buzz, right, when we don't put our seatbelts on. So we remove the buzzing by putting the seatbelt on. So that would be negative reinforcement. Punishment, which is decreasing the behavior, so the ticket would be positive. So we're giving you something to decrease your behavior. The suspended license, we're taking something away from you, your license, in order to decrease your behavior of safe driving. So let's apply this really quick to parenting. So this is a later slide, but I'm not here to question anyone's parenting styles or anything like that, only to introduce this concept of positive reinforcement. So rewarding our children for doing things that they're supposed to be doing instead of punishing them when they don't do it. So if we have a list of chores and they complete them, they then get their phone, their weekend plans, or whatever. That's a simple reframe from saying, if you don't do this, I'm taking it. So it's all reward-based. If you do this, it's an expectation. We set the expectation. You will then have this. Empirically, I can send you a source on this, say, this right here. She talks about being the most productive. For whatever reason, the kids respond to earning that reward. They know they don't have it until they do it, compared to always having it and waiting for parents to catch you messing up and then taking it. So you don't have it, you act the way we, whatever boundaries we set, and then you get it. This is very difficult because it's hard to be consistent. I understand that you're not the only people around your children. So you may be giving a lot of positive reinforcement, but at school they're getting negative reinforcement. My only encouragement is just be as consistent as possible. And I know it's a lot more fatigue to keep up on, okay, did my kid do this? Does he get this? Did he do this? I understand that it can cause some fatigue. But if we set these habits early, 8, 9, even younger, teenage years will be easier to maintain this positive reinforcement because you'll have set a standard for your house. This slide, if I could have you take, I know I've gone over this fast, I'll stay up here, we can talk. If I could have you take anything away from the reinforcement, it's that it's a simple reframe of things I'm sure we're already doing. So it's the difference between, I said this, difference between taking something and earning something. So if you do this, I'm taking your phone, we can plant. In order to have your phone, you must complete. So it's just a simple, simple reframe of what I'm assuming you're already doing. We just need to not think of our kids' extracurriculars as necessities. They are things they get to do if they correctly follow the rules at home. Just like we don't get a paycheck at work if we don't go to work. We do our job and we get a paycheck. Positive reinforcement. So just instilling that into our children, I think just with this simple reframe will allow us to see increased behavior. Because if they want their phone and they don't have it until they do it, the likelihood of them doing it is greatly increased instead of, because this is what kids do, right? If they always have it, well, maybe mom won't notice. Mom is busy. Dad's away. Mom's away. They try to sneak their way around because they already have it. The goal is to not allow them to have these things until they complete the task. And it's not easy, I understand, but I do think it's a helpful way to increase behavior that we want. I really like this, some practical stuff. Reward as close to possible, as close to the action as possible. So if they do something you want them to do, don't wait 10, 15, 20 minutes. Try to catch them as soon as they can. If you're asking them to clean their room and you're in the other room doing chores, maybe peek in and say, oh, I really appreciate you making your bed. Keep it up. And then come back in. Oh, I really appreciate you picking up your clothes. They will continue to do this behavior because they're getting reinforced. I like praising them for starting. I like this. If they do the first half of their homework and they get tired, instead of saying, you need to sit there and do the other half of your homework, maybe a simple reframe is, I really appreciate you doing your first half of your homework. I know that was hard. I really appreciate it. And just encourage them to continue. It just sends a different message when we are consistently rewarding them positively for behavior we want them to do. Validating efforts first before results. I know we live in a very competitive time academically, and we think that one C in eighth grade is going to affect them getting a job in their 20s. But let's make sure that you did I know you didn't do well, but I saw how hard you studied. I really appreciate that you put the effort into studying. That will increase their behavior. That will increase the likelihood that they study for future exams. I think of if they did well on one section. So I'm really proud of how well you're doing on subtraction. I know you need some work with multiplication, but I'm really proud of how well you did on subtraction. There's really as much positive reinforcement as we can with that. I think we're running out of time. I hate that we had to kind of throw a bunch in at the end, but we can give you these slides, and then we'll stay up here and we can chat, and then I'll let Megan close out here.
I just wanted to make sure that I got this in, because I know we have a ton of information here, and I think sometimes, especially with the cultural stuff, we can feel pretty negative. But really, these years are really exciting years for our kids, and it's such a crucial time to, like we said, make our investment into our kids, and they are a great, great time to talk about spiritual things and asking questions about who God is and his plan, or, you know, different things like this. So they're moving out of just kind of accepting what they've been taught and how that's gone to asking some questions about spirituality or God or, you know, whatever. And that's really exciting. We want to engage them on those questions. Talking about different stories of Ruth and Moses, you know, going along with the inferiority in industry, you know, using stories like this to reinforce that God has a plan and wants to use them in an exciting way. So yeah, it's exciting. It's an exciting time to know about. A lot of us here are Christians, and it's great to talk about that with our kids, and to reinforce just the message of that
God wants a relationship with them, and he wants a relationship with all of us. And it's exciting that we don't have to jump through hoops. We don't have to do all of these different tasks to earn acceptance from God, that we just have to ask. And that's super exciting for them to know, for us to talk about with our kids too. So I just wanted to end on a positive note. These times are exciting times for kids. Okay. That's all we had, if there's any questions that you have. Yeah, and I think that we can navigate a little bit with that and asking them, have you ever heard about, you know, what alcohol is, or, you know, and I think getting an idea of what they know already helps a lot to navigate that. So no, we don't want to sit our kids down and give them this big speech on, you know, and this is what an opiate is, or this, you know, and don't use that, you know, just navigate where they're at and work with that. And again, that family dinner project, tons of great just discussion questions. What do you think? You know, what do you think about that? So good question. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. You know, even if our kids, you know, go to small Christian schools or they're homeschooled or anything, they're always around other kids. Yeah, right. I agree. And along with that, the task force discussion that we went to on internet safety training, these guys who are in the trenches seeing just the evil that happens to kids because of their phones, basically, they said you can put all the monitoring software on your kid's phone, but nothing will replace good old-fashioned parenting. Just be aware. Always have your kids in public view of what, you know, they're doing on online. Go ahead. Oh, gosh. No. Oh, my gosh. I so recommend not having a smartphone. I don't think kids need it. They don't. I mean, I think they might need it when they start going to activities and you're dropping them off. They need to be able to text and call, but why do they need a smartphone? And that's my personal opinion. They don't need it. I don't think they need it till they're old enough to pay for it themselves. But yeah.
This study was recorded at Zenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.